Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Have you tried booking a summer trip in the past few weeks, feeling that sticker shock when you see how much an airline ticket costs now? It's definitely a sign that travel is starting to ramp back up and the demand is strong. But should you hold out and wait for the market to cool down? We're going to discuss that and where you need to get a so-called vaccine passport if you want to travel to certain destinations. Plus, speaking of vaccine passports, you'll need that or at least a negative COVID test to go to a San Francisco Giants game. Their home opener is tomorrow. But if you go across the bay, you don't need any of that to catch an A's game. We'll find out why and some of the other changes coming this season to Oracle Park in San Francisco. But first, spring break is wrapping up for tens of thousands of students in our area. Monday will mark the first time many schools will open their doors to students, teachers, and staff in more than a year. Many schools have already had in-person instruction for a few days a week, and many private schools have been open the entire time. But the bulk of students will be going back on Monday, April 12th, coming off the spring break or Easter holiday. Governor Newsom last month offered financial incentives to school districts that do open, and it appears many have taken the offer and are opening. But for those students, parents, guardians, while the return to school may be welcomed, COVID is still here. And schools have been prepping for the return to school for months now. Joining us to discuss this is pulmonologist and critical care physician at Sutter Roseville Medical Center and medical director at the Sutter Valley Area Electronic ICU, Dr. Vanessa Walker. Thanks for joining us on Insight.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Walker, you know, when I was going to work today within Sac City Unified, I saw one school already having the balloon arch welcoming students back. Some staff were dressed up in costumes. Someone was dressed up in a dinosaur. So it really just a long overdue kind of burst of excitement and welcoming for students and staff. For many families, Monday is going to be back to school for a lot more students. In your expertise, if you just kind of run through why now is the right time for kids to go back to school?
Well, you know, I don't know that I'm going to weigh in on the policy of that, right? We have a lot of people that are making these decisions and I think have the best interests of all of our, the health of our population in mind. The key thing that I want to focus on are what are the things that we can do to make sure that we're staying safe when we bring our kids back to school. The number one thing is going to be continuing to do your mask wearing, wear them appropriately and at all times when you're outside of your home, and make sure that your kids are doing the same thing. We've been doing this for over a year. We know how to do it and we have so much data that shows that it works. So whether you're wearing your cloth masks or you're purchasing masks online, just making sure that you're not only wearing them, but you're wearing them in the right way. You're wearing them above your nose, below your chin, and making sure that in some cases, if you double mask, we have literature showing double masking is more effective, right, as well as doing the what's called the tie and tuck method with your disposable masks. It helps decrease any gaps on your face. So that's going to be the main thing. And making sure that if you're sick, you do not go to school or send your children to school with any kind of illness. That is going to be really key.
And although there's a lot of excitement, and we know about the mask wearing and social distancing, yeah, the school environment is going to feel and look a little bit different. On the front end, when it comes to families preparing their children to go back to school, is there anything they can do on the front end as they prepare for class on Monday?
You know, it's funny that you said that, because I don't know that I have any specific advice on that. But I remember people were very concerned about their children, you know, not handling wearing masks or being unable to tell people's emotions when they were wearing them. And I remember looking at my 5-year-old and I asked her, you know, Selma, how do you tell when mommy's smiling? And she said, I just look at your eyes, mom. You know, kids are resilient. They know the emotions that are going on. I realize that there are some kids that have a little bit more difficult time, but our kids are ready to get back to school, to see their friends. They're up for the challenge. I really think that they're going to do well. They have been doing a great job at following rules, keeping everybody healthy. And I have a lot of faith in our kids that we're going to do just fine.
A pretty significant development came down last night. Pfizer is reporting that their vaccine is 100% effective in kids age 12 to 15 and that the side effects are similar to the ones adults experience. Now, they still need to submit that new data to the FDA, but I would imagine that could be potentially a game changer in kind of solidifying the confidence in reopening schools.
Absolutely. You know, right now, kids 16 and up, you know, are able to get a vaccine once they open it up for their peer group. But once we have 12-year-olds and up, you know, the adolescent population, high schoolers, they pass around COVID the same way that adults do. So it is going to be really important to get that group vaccinated. And then hopefully, you know, once more information comes out, we'll be able to get our younger kids vaccinated. But I think if we can get the 12 to 18 age group vaccinated, it's going to make things a whole lot safer, not just for our kids, but for our entire community.
Yeah, coupled with teachers and staff. The New York Times is reporting that 80% of teachers have received at least one vaccination shot. So if you can just explain the importance of educators getting the vaccine as well.
Yeah, so educators, you are the guardians at the gate on, another surge, I think. It is really your duty to get vaccinated to make sure that you're making sure that we don't spread this around not only the communities, but your own families and to yourselves. One dose of a vaccine can get you about 80% effectiveness. That second dose is really key to get you up to that 95% efficacy if you're looking at the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine. And then with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, just remember one dose, which is all it takes, will give you 100% effectiveness against hospitalization and death. And with the B.1.1.7 variant running around right now, that is the main variant that's causing disease across the country. That is hitting younger people. So a lot of our, you know, people are thinking, well, I'm young, I'm healthy, I don't really have any risk. You do. You mm-hmm. are at risk. We're seeing people in the hospital in those age groups. So please protect yourselves.
Have you seen that here locally as a physician?
Yes, we've seen many people that are younger that never thought that they would be getting COVID and getting sick with it in that age group. Absolutely.
You know, many schools also, they're offering COVID testing. So even if your child is not sick, is testing still important to do, even say if, you know, the rest of the household, the adults are vaccinated?
Yeah, I mean, it's getting the testing done is going to be part of contact tracing. So even if you're not showing symptoms, they might ask you to do testing just to make sure that if you had been exposed to somebody that you're not a silent carrier. I don't think that you need to go around and get yourself tested, you know, on a frequent basis, just following the good rules and making sure that if you do become symptomatic, get testing done. But if you are asked to get a test for contact tracing purposes, then absolutely that would be an important thing to do.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with pulmonologist and critical care physician at Sutter Roseville Medical Center and medical director of the Sutter Valley Area Electronic ICU, Dr. Vanessa Walker. Dr. Walker, Governor Newsom on Tuesday made a big announcement that California might be able to get back to normal, fully reopen the economy by June if vaccine supply remains steady, hospitalizations remain low. I mean, that's just 2 months away. That's just around the corner. As a physician, what's going through your mind as the economy starts to reopen?
You know, it's mixed feelings. I am so hopeful that as we continue to get people vaccinated, we're not going to see anything like what we had to deal with in December and January. That was probably some of the scariest times for me ever being a physician, and I don't ever want to go through something like that again. But I am wary, and you know, every time we get a new COVID case in the hospital, my heart skips a little bit, and I think, is this the start of another wave? But so far, we've been holding our own and making sure that everybody who comes in is getting the best care possible. I really think as we get more and more people vaccinated, we're going to be fine. So if you're on the fence, millions and millions of people have been vaccinated. We're doing well. I've been vaccinated since January with no side effects. This is your chance to really get everybody back to somewhat of a new normal and make hopefully 2022 feel like a great year.
You know, when you just shared that the winter surge was one of the most difficult times in your career as a physician, can you elaborate on that a little bit more? I think it's really important for people to understand the gravity of what's happening inside hospitals when we do have those surges over the past year.
Yeah, I mean, I remember not only having to sign, I signed 5 death certificates in 10 days, and I've never had to do that. Mm-hmm. It was just so many people passing away. And then I had, you know, a family member that couldn't say goodbye to their loved one with COVID, and they were standing outside the door with their hands on the glass, just sobbing, and I'm sobbing with them. And so it was some heartbreaking things, and it was nothing compared to what other hospital systems had to deal with in New York and in Southern California, but it was still heartbreaking. And I wouldn't wish that on any family member. So that's why I've always been, you know, so pressing so much for the community to please do their part because I don't ever want to be your doctor.
Right. I can understand why that gives you mixed feelings as we may reopen the economy in the summer. And I would imagine the outlying factors and unknowns with the variants probably adds to the concern.
Yeah, fortunately, we're seeing that the variants are covered by the vaccines we currently have, which is excellent. But the more times we give this virus opportunities to spread, the more chance we're going to give it to get a new variant that may not be covered by our vaccine. So that's why it is so important to get vaccinated as quickly as possible and cut down the spread of this disease.
And I think it's important to reiterate that normal on June 15th is not going to be normal like before the pandemic. We're still going to be wearing masks for the foreseeable future and practicing social distancing, correct?
I would suspect. I think that's the safest thing to do moving forward. And until we have a good therapeutic out there that's going to be able to treat this disease very rapidly in an oral form that people, your doctor can prescribe you from home, I still think mask wearing is going to be kind of in our future. We need more help on the front lines of treating this virus before we just go back to normal.
And we're going to discuss this in a few more minutes, but heading into summer, families are going to prepare for break and traveling. What are your thoughts on traveling safe?
So, you know, with getting onto airplanes, I think airplanes are probably actually pretty safe. Everybody on them is excited about going somewhere and they're avoiding getting sick. So keeping your masks on the whole time, the airlines are requiring them. Many of them are requiring either proof of vaccination or negative tests. So I think it's probably going to be fairly safe looking at traveling. I still am not planning on traveling yet. I'm staying close to home, making sure that, you know, I'm not participating in any, you know, possible spreading of illness. I just don't quite feel comfortable yet. But I think as we start moving forward and people start traveling, we're just going to see what happens. Continue, like I said, do everything that we know works, wearing those masks appropriately. That's a key thing, appropriately. If you're sick, please stay home. Don't go anywhere.
Yeah, and that's just really a great point. It's all about comfort level, because if you're not comfortable, you're not going to even enjoy the vacation. And destinations aren't really, they're not going anywhere, right? So if you don't feel comfortable, you want to wait and see, you can take your time and make your decision when you feel ready.
Yep.
Thank you so much, Dr. Walker. We always appreciate your time and expertise.
No, thank you.
Up next, the CDC's new guidance for people who've been vaccinated. Is it already leading to a travel boom? And will you be welcomed if you have had your shots? Plus, play ball.
Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back.
The Giants home opener is tomorrow, but there are a few things to bring with you if you want to watch a game in person. You can join the conversation too. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Spring is here. Baseball, it's back. With modifications, of course. If you're heading out to the ballpark, some of the things to bring may include a baseball cap, sunglasses, sunscreen, definitely a glove in case you're lucky enough to catch that foul ball or a home run. But some ballparks around the country are requiring that you bring a negative COVID test or a vaccination card, and you must show you've been fully vaccinated and have waited 2 weeks. Tomorrow is the Giants' home opener, and along with that, the hat and the gloves, the Giants are requiring that fans show up to prove they have been fully vaccinated or have tested negative. Joining us to talk about the new protocols for this season is Stacy Slaughter. She is the Executive Vice President of Communications and Senior Advisor for the San Francisco Giants. Stacy, thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm betting you can already gauge the pent-up demand that Giants fans are feeling for tomorrow.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you really think about it, we haven't had fans in the ballparks for about 18 months. The last game where we had fans was the final game of the 2019 season. It was Bruce Bochy's retirement game. A lot has changed in those 18 months for sure.
Well, we know the Giants, obviously a huge fan base here in the greater Sacramento region and northern Nevada. We have the team's AAA team, the Sacramento River Cats. So just a lot of fans are going to be making that trip to San Francisco. Walk us through the new protocols this year.
Great. Thank you. Well, I grew up in Sacramento, so I very much understand how deep Giants fandom runs deep in the Sacramento area. We are asking fans to take an extra step. We have been working, health and safety has been our number one priority as we've planned for the safe return of fans. And we've been working in lockstep with both our local and state public health officials on the best way and the safest way to reopen Oracle Park. And so through that process, a number of guidelines were identified, and the San Francisco Public Health Officer imposed some conditions for us to be able to reopen the ballpark. We will be reopening the ballpark at 22% capacity, which translates into about 8,900 fans. And those fans who are coming to the game will obviously need to bring their game ticket, and equally important, be prepared to show proof of a negative COVID test whose results you've received within 3 days of the game that you're planning to attend, or a copy of your vaccination card. And that would be a completed vaccination card, depending on the vaccine you received. It would be after the second dose and a 2-week waiting period for Moderna and Pfizer, and after the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, a full 2-week waiting period. And we're asking fans to be prepared to show that information, and that will, so that they can comply with what we have planned for random inspections at the gates.
Yeah, you touched upon this, but I think it's important to reiterate who decided to put the protocols in place. Is this a combination of the team and city and county health department, or was it more the health department in San Francisco County?
Well, similar to a restaurant or any business, it's really up to the public health department to determine the best way to reopen. And so we have been working with them. We had to submit to them, once San Francisco moved into the red tier, we had to submit an operating plan to the Department of Public Health that talked about how we would operate the ballpark in a limited capacity environment, what protocols would be in place. You know, mask wearing is the obvious one. All of our tickets are located in 2 and 4 seating pods, and they're all socially distanced throughout the ballpark. We have 9 zones in the ballpark where fans will be assigned to sit in a specific zone, and those zones will have your restroom, your concession stands. And as the health department was reviewing our plan, they also wanted to impose the condition of having fans comply with a negative test or full vaccination. And the thing that's really important to remember is this will be the very first major public event where you have a large crowd gathering for the first time in San Francisco.
Over 8,000 people, correct?
Exactly. Close to 9,000 people. And that's the fans. And then obviously you have the workers. And what we identified through our research with our fans, and as we've been planning for this, you know, that health and safety is the number one concern, both of the Giants and of our fans. And so we are really allowing science and the public health officials and the experts in this field to really help us create the safest environment for our fans, for our employees, and for the communities surrounding the ballpark as well.
Does that explain why that, you know, because you could have had a little bit more, a higher percentage of capacity, correct? But you're sticking around 25% as opposed to 33% that was technically allotted with the tier that San Francisco is currently in.
Well, it's a little confusing in the sense that the state does allow for 33% in the orange tier. However, both the state and the local public health officials in all the counties where there are major league ballparks require social distancing between the seats. So in our case, In order to socially distance all those seating pods, we can really only reach 22% capacity. So, you know, unless those social distancing guidelines change in some way, you're really not going to see any major league team getting up to that 33% just because you just don't have the real estate within the ballpark to make it happen.
Yeah, tapping into Major League Baseball, you know, just across the country, what other teams have these kind of protocols?
So we are the only team in California. However, in New York, both the Mets and the Yankees have similar type guidelines and conditions that they have to follow. You know, obviously we're in a, you know, our ballpark is in a urban dense environment in the city. San Francisco is one of the more dense cities in the country. New York obviously is in a similar situation. And, you know, you have to factor in how people get to the ballpark. It's not just driving. You know, many of the ballparks in California are surrounded by large parking lots. And so the vast majority of their fans drive. In New York, in San Francisco, you know, we have more than half of our fans take public transit to the ballpark or they walk. And so I think the public health officials really want to make sure that not just when you're in the ballpark, you're safe, but as you're exiting the ballpark and the surrounding neighborhoods, you have, you know, protocols in place that really help prevent any transmission of COVID. And also, you know, San Francisco has done a really wonderful job of helping to manage the pandemic during this difficult time. And, you know, we've had relatively few deaths and, you know, our hospitalizations have been pretty, you know, low compared to other areas. And so, you know, it's really a testament to how the city is run and the community as a whole have really stepped up and done their part to make sure that, you know, we stay healthy.
You know, when you're talking just about logistically the space of San Francisco and Oracle Park, that probably explains why just across the bay, the Oakland A's in Alameda County, and it is a different county, but why they don't have the same protocols, and even though they're still in the orange tier.
Yeah, I mean, the Coliseum is a much bigger facility, obviously, because it used to accommodate both football and baseball. The parking lot, you know, it's amazing. They have probably one of the best run mass vaccination centers going on in the country right now, and they're hosting baseball games. They just have a lot more space there. You know, and obviously, you know, our ballpark is located right in a neighborhood, with, you know, residents, and UCSF is just down the block. So, you know, we just want to make sure that we can create the safest environment for our employees, for our fans, for our neighbors. And we've been working hand in hand with the city to make sure that we do that. And hopefully as the conditions improve, you know, more than 50% of San Francisco adults are vaccinated now, you know, as more vaccinations, you know, are made available and as cases continue to decline, you know, some of these restrictions are likely to loosen, you know, as the season progresses. But we really appreciate the cooperation of our fans. You know, they're taking these, you know, guidelines very, very seriously.
And just poking around a little bit, the Cincinnati Reds, they're actually offering discounts to people who have been vaccinated, $10 tickets. Any plans for some kind of incentivization like that for a Giants game and Giants fans?
You know, we've been involved with the community about promoting the importance of vaccinations. We haven't gotten down to that point yet in terms of ticket sales and things like that, but we've been a part of a big public awareness campaign that the mayor launched just last week, trying to get people from all different walks of life and all aspects of the city vaccinated as quickly as possible. And I mean, it's, you see the Bay Area and just the way that the public health officers have worked hand in hand together as a region, as well as, you know, the leadership that is, you know, been demonstrated by our mayor and our public health officials. You know, it's really impressive to see. And we're just really proud that the community has really stepped up. And then our fan base, I mean, I know this is an extra step for our fans and, you know, some may see as an inconvenience, but we've also heard from many of our fans that really appreciate the extra layer just to make sure, because it's all new and it's uncharted territory. So we're going to take it slowly and hopefully get it right.
You know, the reality is some people are going to try and skirt the new protocols. What happens if, say, someone tries to get in with someone else's vaccine card or someone else's COVID test results? Is there a plan or mitigation to resolve that and prevent that?
Well, if you're selected as part of that regular random screening, not only do you have to show your vaccination card, you'll have to show your government issued ID to go along with it. So we make sure that it's the, you know, right card corresponding with the right person. So, you know, it's similar to like when you go through security at the airport and things like that, we will have checks in place to make sure that it is, in fact, the person they purport to be.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Stacy Slaughter, Executive Vice President of Communications and Senior Advisor with the San Francisco Giants, about the team's new attendance protocols as they prepare for their home opener. Now, can you talk to us about the FanSafe portal, how that works, mm-hmm. and why people should try and take advantage of that?
Sure. Thank you for bringing that up. So we have created kind of a one-stop shop on our website at sfgiants.com/fansafe. And that's all the information you need to know about our health and safety protocols, what you need to know before you come to the ballpark around, you know, how you get tested, what paperwork you need to bring. We have, you know, one of the options for coming to the ballpark and showing your negative test is that, you know, fans can download the Clear Health Pass. It's an app-based program that is linked to a number of testing facilities and healthcare providers around the Bay Area, such as Kaiser, Dignity Health, Go Health Clinics, you know, Sutter, things like that. And so all of the information about, you know, what you need to bring with you to the ballpark, what the experience is when you get there, you know, when you're on your ticket, we're going to ask people to specifically go to entrances that are closest to their seats in the ballpark so that we try to spread out the arrivals of our fans. And then when you're sitting in your seating zone, you know, where, how do you order food? We have an app that fans can order food and then go pick up at the concession stand nearest their seats. We have assigned restrooms to them. Again, all in the effort to spread everybody out and be socially distanced to the best possible way.
How many people can actually sit together when it comes to families, large families, or, you know, people of the same household or cohorts? Mm-hmm.
So our seating pods are limited to twos and fours, you know, and you could buy, say, if you had a family of four or family of eight, for example, you could buy two, you know, seating pods of four in the same section, for example.
Got it.
But we've divided those up, and then the seats that will not be in use have been zip tied. And so it's very clear where you're able to sit and where you're not able to sit.
And what are the changes when it comes to buying food and beverages?
So fans will be able to purchase food. What they do is we have the At the Ballpark app that fans, usually your tickets are linked to the ballpark app. And on that same app, there's an order food option. We also have QR codes that are posted at every seating pod. So you could also, you know, order it that way. But there will be menu on the app. You order your food, you pay for it, it tells you where to pick it up, and you'll get a text to tell you, you know, okay, your food is ready, go to the Doggy Diner concession stand behind, you know, section 125, and that'll be, you know, linked closest to wherever your seats are. And so, you know, it's obviously, given the restrictions that we have, it's going to be a different experience than our fans have been used to. In terms of, you know, being able to walk all the way around the ballpark and things like that, you know, we're going to, you know, start out slow and, you know, get people comfortable being back together in a large setting, and have as many, you know, food opportunities as we can available. But we think this is the safest way to operate. We know that other ballparks around the state that opened last week, they have a similar app-based program. There were some glitches, I think, the first opening day, but it seems that one of the benefits of opening on the road is that we get to see what all the glitches are and then have those fixed before we start. So,
well, this week so was also a pretty big week for Giants AAA team as well here in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. For the first time in 574 days, it sounds like an eternity, you know, around 520 fans were able to return to Sutter Health Park in West Sacramento and catch a scrimmage between the alternate site squads for the Giants and the Oakland A's. Can you talk to us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be a fun way to see baseball. Obviously, I love that ballpark. It's one of my favorite ballparks. But it is the alternate site is where our players who could be called up, you know, should we have an injury or we need to make a change, they're training full time at the Rivercat Stadium. That's where our hottest young minor league players are, you know, training right now, from Joey Bart to Elliot Ramos. They have opened the facility to fans. I think they're selling a limited number of tickets when they're scrimmaging the Stockton ports. I just think it's such a fun way to go see kind of the future stars of the San Francisco Giants. I mean, we have one of the best, I think we're now like rated top five of all of baseball in our minor league system. And which, if you think back, you know, this is, I'm not making any promises here, but, you know, when we had a farm system of that caliber 10 years ago, you know, we saw what happened once those players started to mature and then come up in our system. So we're excited to have that caliber of group down there training. And if you have a chance to go, I think they play every couple of days around 1 o'clock. It's worth it to just go watch some great baseball.
Finally, the big announcement this week, Governor Newsom says that the hope is California can get back to normal by June 15th. When you hear that, what does that mean to a team like the Giants and the fans?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, we are cautiously optimistic that, you know, we'll continue to be able to welcome more and more fans back to Oracle Park as more people get vaccinated, as, you know, cases of COVID continue to decline in our state. I think from a symbolic gesture, not just for our fans, but for our state as a whole and for our community as a whole, you know, spring training is always this, or the opening of the season is always this kind of moment of, you know, hope and renewal. And I think it symbolizes that, you know, the economy is going to start to come back, that the Bay Area is going to start to come back, and all the negativity. It just, it's a significant symbol for our, you know, community. And I think it's a really, the nice thing about baseball is it's outdoors. It's a nice way for people to reconnect in a relatively safe environment after being so sheltered for so many months. But I think we're really excited about the prospect of our fans, and we've heard it from our fans too, that they're really ready to get back to the ballpark. I'm still working from home. I haven't been back to my office since March, so I will be there tomorrow, and I'm very excited to go back into my office and welcome the fans back.
Well, I'm sure it's going to be an emotional day in all the best ways, and there's just a lot to look forward to this season.
Yes, absolutely.
Stacy Slaughter is the Executive Vice President of Communications and Senior Advisor with the San Francisco Giants. Thank you so much for joining us, and good luck to the Giants this year.
Thank you, Vicki. Take care.
Well, last year, summer was pretty much a dud for just about everyone who likes to travel, take in a game at the ballpark, or head to a theme park. But it appears this year, hopefully, things will be different. According to the TSA, last Thursday and Friday, around 1.5 million people went through TSA checkpoints. Well, last year, on those same days, it was just over 100,000, so less than 10% of that number. Travel appears to be back. People appear to be more comfortable getting on airplanes, and the lines at airports show it. Same with the ticket prices. Our next guest, Lily Fu, joined us last month to talk about summer travel, but a few things have changed since then. First, the rate of vaccinations across the country has increased substantially. And second, the CDC just came out with new guidelines for people who have been fully vaccinated. We've invited Lily back. She is the executive producer and airline vertical lead with TravelZoo. That's an online travel company. Lily, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks for having me, Vicki.
Well, Lily, let's begin with the first big news. Since the last time you were on Insight last month, according to the CDC, fully vaccinated people 2 weeks after the final dose of the vaccine can travel at low risk to themselves. These people are free to travel to the U.S. without COVID-19 testing or post-travel quarantine, so long as they continue to take those COVID-19 precautions while traveling, wearing such a mask, avoiding crowds, social distancing, and frequent hand washing. What has this done to the airline and travel industry, which has really just suffered so much this past year?
Yeah, I think it's really led to a lot of traveler confidence, quite frankly, knowing that if they can get a vaccine, and their peers and their fellow travelers do as well, that they're going to be safe wherever they're traveling to. So I think the travel industry in general is feeling particularly bullish at this point. We've started to see airlines add some capacity. You know, a lot of airlines have dropped the middle seat being blocked, so they're starting to sell those. I myself was just in Arizona on a road trip last week, and it was crowded everywhere I went. So these are the beginning signs of people starting to feel more comfortable with the idea of getting out and about, hopping on planes, especially knowing that there's going to be that added layer of protection now in knowing that more people are getting vaccinated.
What has this done or is going to do in terms of travel trends? Are people booking business trips? Are they just going all out and doing long vacations, going outside of the country? Or is it more like quick weekend getaways?
Yeah, so on our side, we've been working with a lot of partners on deals to both drive market destinations, so places, you know, within about 100 to 100 miles of where you live. And those continue to be very popular. But what we're also starting to see is a lot of our partners are offering travel deeper into 2021, into 2022 even, so that it gives people that time to plan for big international trips. And we've started to see a very slow uptick in bookings for big international trips, especially knowing that they are going to be fully vaccinated. And there are even some international destinations that have started to open their doors to fully vaccinated people as well. So Iceland is a perfect example of a destination that recently reopened to fully vaccinated travelers. You can show proof of a vaccination in the form of a card or some kind of medical record to show that you've been fully vaccinated, and you don't have to go into quarantine or you don't have to subject yourself to a negative COVID test before you leave. The one thing I will say is that upon returning internationally, the U.S. is still requiring people to take a COVID test 3 to 5 days before returning to prove that they are negative before reentering.
Now let's just talk about pricing. Airline prices seem to be steep. I mean, when I look from 1 week to another, it rose exponentially following the CDC updated guidelines. Are airlines trying to understandably recoup the money lost from the last year, or is this just really a longer term trend and we just got to be saving a little bit more if we want to travel within the next year?
So what I'm seeing on the airline trend side is that you could still get a great deal through spring, so through May. Once summer hits, that's when we're starting to see the regular summer pricing creep in again. And then even into fall right now, prices are starting to rise. So my advice for travelers out there, if you are interested in traveling later this year, is to potentially grab that ticket. However, know that airlines are also working on assessing their capacity right now. As they're seeing travelers come back in market and certain popular routes come back, there is that desire, and airlines have expressed that they do want to start adding more planes to certain routes so that there's more frequency in terms of how often they fly during the week. So there is a very small chance that prices could dip, but my feeling honestly is that with the ongoing demand surging for people to get out and about, that right now is probably still the best time to lock yourself in. The other thing is that certain airlines are still extending the offer to travelers to change their tickets without any kind of penalty. So, look into those policies, those airline policies. There are a few that are still allowing it, which also begs or argue is a good argument for you to book your ticket now versus later.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Lily Fu, executive producer with Travelzoo. Now, speaking of demand, I mean, let's talk about rental cars. NPR had a story this week about some destinations just completely out of rental cars, or maybe they only had a couple at really just like ridiculous costs to rent the car. What's going on with that?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Rental cars were extremely popular this past year, understandably, because people weren't willing to hop on planes. They wanted to hop in a car, be able to drive somewhere very close and go on a getaway. like I said, I myself just went on a long road trip to Arizona I'm in Los Angeles. And what I'm hearing from folks who are interested in getting a rental car, whether that's for a road trip or whether it's they're flying somewhere and trying to rent, is that inventory is shrinking. What happened with a lot of rental cars at the beginning of the pandemic is they were either sold off or they've been parked in lots and just kind of collecting dust for the past year. So they're in a very similar situation to airlines where they're trying to assess capacity right now and demand, and they are probably going to slowly start to bring their fleet back. But for now, we're suffering through it a little bit because the inventory is low. There's not a lot of cars to choose from and prices are high. So this is the classic supply and demand situation we're seeing with rental cars right now. I will mention that there is an interesting company out there called Turo. Think of it as the Airbnb of cars. What they do is they allow private car owners to be able to rent their cars out on their own, make a little extra cash. You get arguably, in a lot of cases, a nicer vehicle for about the same price as you would pay for a compact car. So that's another thing that people can also consider doing.
Finally, there's a lot of hotspots here in California, and the big ones are theme parks. Disneyland announced their reopening April 30th. Not everything will be open, of course, and there's some rules and regulations. But can you walk us through some of the measures in place for theme parks like Disneyland or even potentially Magic Mountain, SeaWorld, Six Flags, and all that fun stuff?
Sure. Yeah. So Disneyland is set to start selling tickets next week. They have a planned reopening for the end of the month to California residents only at this point. But SeaWorld, Legoland, Six Flags, California's Great America, they have all reopened with limited capacity and potentially also some limited access to different rides and things like that. They are not requiring anyone to be fully vaccinated to visit. They are, however, implementing the usual, CDC guidelines of social distancing, wearing a mask. They're doing temperature checks at the gate. So, they haven't implemented as strict requirements as, say, some international destinations, but certainly with the decreased capacity and the basic CDC guidelines that they're following, I think they're hoping to create a safe experience for people who are returning to these parks.
Lily Fu is the executive producer with Travelzoo. Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Still ahead, once an old abandoned power station on the side of the Sacramento River, now transformed into a gorgeous modern science and learning center. We're going to learn more about Sacramento's newest attraction, the Museum of Science and Curiosity. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Sandwiched between the Sacramento River on the west, Interstate 5 on the east, right on Jaboom Street near downtown for years, rests an old PG&E power station. The building was built back in the early 1900s, but in 2018, the Museum of Science and Curiosity began to take shape, or MOSAC for short. You may have noticed the dome at the top while driving southbound on I-5 just before you got off the J Street exit, and MOSAC is just a few weeks from its grand opening. Joining us to talk about this great addition to the Sacramento arts and culture landscape is Shanaz Van Deventer. Thank you for joining us, and I love your name.
Oh, thank you, Vicki. It's quite a mouthful.
Well, talk to us about how construction is coming along.
You know, we are so grateful to our partners at Auto Construction for, you know, navigating COVID and all the rules and regulations around there to really keep this project on track. As you mentioned, breaking ground in 2018 and setting a rapid pace to completion, we're within weeks of actually getting final permitting to take occupancy of the building. Our planned opening actually is pushed into the fall, but we are having a lot of pre-opening events that we'll probably be discussing in a few minutes.
You know, and you just talked about the challenge of all of this. What I love when driving along I-5 is you can see that you didn't just demo the entire building. You're preserving the exterior and preserving the history as you kind of elevate the building into modern times and modern uses.
That's right. It's been, you know, interesting to pick apart that building. I don't know if everyone recalls that exoskeleton that we had out there just to shore up the walls so we could get in there and do that rehabilitation and reinvent that beautiful building that was built in the Beaux-Arts concept. And it was a Willis Polk design, as a matter of fact. And so we took that, we renovated it, and then we have two new building additions, which includes the entry pavilion and that full dome digital theater complex.
You mentioned that the opening got pushed back a little bit to the fall, but there's going to be some pre-opening experiences for people to enjoy MOSAC before fall. Talk to us about some of those events that you'll be holding.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the very first things we are going to be doing is holding in-person summer camps.
Fine.
So it's going to be fabulous for those kids. I know that they're itching to get outside and parents are itching to, you know, shoo them along to get outside. So we are going to be holding, you know, camps that are going to go Monday through Friday, 5 days a week. They are scheduled to run from June to August, and we'll be getting those kids just really back entrenched. You know, they're stuck in front of a computer all day long, and this is going to be an opportunity to kind of address that issue of how do you get those kids reacclimated back into that environment with their peers and learning and playing. So we're giving them that opportunity with our summer camps.
Yeah, that long overdue interaction in the learning environment, right?
Exactly. You know, there are going to be a lot of things that you have to think about when you're addressing learning loss as well. And so what a great opportunity to get them back in a fun way while they're learning and playing and communicating with their peers as well on all things really cool and sciencey.
And I would imagine there's going to be social distancing and protocols for those summer camps.
Absolutely. We are following state and county guidelines, and will be the safety of our campers is paramount.
When it comes to kind of planning for the opening in fall, do you have a membership program already up and running?
Oh, my goodness. We actually launched our membership program back in February, and it was so exciting to see the community just come alive. One of the benefits of early membership will be some sneak preview events that we'll be holding. Right now, you mentioned, you know, our opening, and we are scheduling that for about the first weekend of October right now, again, all COVID permitting. But we'll be having a number of events as we come along. One of the things I didn't mention about the summer campers is that they will be the ones who will first experience our exhibits as they are being installed. And early membership also has that benefit, where we'll be getting everyone in there to have a sneak peek before we open to the public as a whole.
Yeah, when I've been driving down, as many people, I've only been able to see the exterior tape shape. What do you love about the interior and the exhibits you're going to have?
You know, the hands-on aspect of it, of course, engaging in themes that are absolutely global, but with incredible local relevance. So all of our exhibit experiences are designed with responsibility and sustainability. And we'll be looking at gallery experiences that address health, nature, water, energy, space, and design engineering. And our marquee and signature experience will be that digital dome theater. It is going to be the only public planetarium in all of Northern California.
Wow.
And to offer that to this community is really a privilege. So we're really pretty excited about that. And not only will we be able to show star shows, but we'll have access to an entire library of films produced for digital dome projection.
I can already kind of feel the pent up excitement for the opening and also the pre-reopening, especially that the kids get to see it firsthand.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
Thanks, Vicki.
And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight, or you can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Cap Radio's technical director, Mark Jones, and engineer is Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.